The Canby Report was produced and recorded on the traditional territories of the Kwikwetlem, Mississaugas of the Credit, Anishinaabeg, Chippewa, Haudenosaunee, and Wendat peoples.
It's May 16th, 2023, and there are 1,250 days left until the Vancouver municipal elections. This is the Canby Report. I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
I have to say, there is something that just like filled me with existential dread about opening this particular show notes, because, and I know you did this so that I wouldn't read it, but just have the date of next election, October 2026, and then there's just a big strike through it, and I'm like, things have really... Have I missed something? Have we overthrown democracy? And the answer of that to that particular question is not yet and not so fast. We will, of course, be talking about the slow-rolling attempt to overthrow our democracies
from China?
Within.
Not from China.
No. It is, of course,
despite what some former mayors continue to allege.
Who?
Don't worry about it. We're not going to talk about him. I don't want to.
Yeah. I don't know. I remember Gregor, and then there was like a kind of haze for a while, and then like I know Ken Sim was running, but it seemed like it took him like a really long time for him to take office, and I just can't remember anything in between.
Help improve our memory. Patreon.com/CanbyReport.
Yes, Patreon.com/CanbyReport, your source for citizen journalism here in the beautiful city of Vancouver and its environs. Patreon.com/CanbyReport. Policing!
So many stories to talk about. So much going on. It's all pretty bleak or clownish. I guess are the only two ways to get around it. The first thing I wanted to get into is the story of Miles Gray, which I don't think we've ever talked about on this podcast, but it is one that has been ongoing on and off for 7 years, since August 2015, when this 33-year-old man died.
Yes. So on August 13th, 2015, a unarmed man who was working as a delivery florist got into some kind of altercation with a homeowner who was watering her lawn during the drought. Whatever happened, and ultimately the result of that confrontation was that 9 Vancouver Police Department officers ultimately responded to Mr. Gray, and not to mince words, they beat him to death. The Independent Investigations Office did what they did and investigated, and this case has been forwarded to BC Prosecution. In December 2020, they ultimately opted not to charge any of the officers, as there was uncertainty in the cause of death and no independent witnesses.
9 people were there when he died, but none of them wanted to talk.
No, they did not. And wait, what's that called? Omerta? Anyway, a new final report has been completed. This was completed in February of 2022 by Richmond RCMP Sergeant Robert Nash on the request of the Office of the Police Complaints Commissioner. And that report has only come to light after being obtained by CBC News in the past several months.
That one included a series of bombshell allegations that were reported in a series of stories. The report does allege that unnamed union officials, and this is from constables who were there when Miles Gray died, that the union officials told them to, quote, not make any handwritten notes and to destroy any they'd taken. There were also statements from Burnaby firefighter responders who were told by VPD not to approach. Some said that they had seen him still alive. Others said he was not when they first arrived there, but all agreed that VPD officers were on Miles Gray's neck.
So why would you not want to make any kind of handwritten notes in that kind of circumstance? Well, that is because those little police notebooks they do effectively the same job as a body camera. They not only record what a criminal of any ostensible ilk might be doing, but also they create a record of the police's actions in any given circumstance. Like, they, in an era before portable cameras, that was their particular way of keeping track of what they did. And those are disclosable. They can be accessed by court order. They can form the basis of prosecutions.
And this is why, without those, the prosecution service decided they could not proceed against charges on this. There was no evidence besides people who are unwilling to say who did what.
Yes. The Metro Vancouver Transit Police Chief, David Jones, is leading a discipline process under the Office of the Police Complaints Commissioner, which is alleging abuse of authority by 5 constables and 1 other officer, which could result in discipline leading up to and including dismissal from the force, which honestly to me seems like a bare fucking minimum, but far be it for me to demand that the people charged with serving and protecting our society do such things in a way that does not kill us.
Aside from that OPCC disciplinary process that's undergoing, there was recently a coroner's jury inquest, which had 11 days of public hearings on this case in April. This was probably the most public, visible recounting of what happened back in August 2015, as officers who were there, family members, and other experts were all invited to give testimony and be examined and cross-examined to discuss it. That inquest ultimately ended with a jury verdict that classified the death as a homicide. Now, this is a neutral term within the context here. The jury was tasked with choosing between accidental, natural suicide, or an undetermined cause of death, or homicide, and they chose homicide. So they're not saying the officer specifically murdered him, but that he did die by homicide, if that passive voice makes any sense.
Yeah, so a homicide is any type of unlawful killing. It could include manslaughter, it can include murder, it can be negligent homicide, for example. It does not ascribe culpability. That's not what the coroner's inquest is there for, but it does make a determination as to why this man died and whether or not 9 people beating him to death with batons and shoes was, you know, natural causes or not. And it turned out it was not.
The officers have always maintained their innocence, making claims about how superhuman strength Miles Gray was showing at the time. And yet what we saw in this inquest is the officers got out of this brawl with someone who was apparently, you know, hyped up on drugs and adrenaline in their estimation, with, I think, 2 had minor injuries, and a third, I forget exactly what it was described as, but basically scratched himself on a tree, and that was written up as part of the harms caused to the officers during this altercation. He ran through a tree. Thanks.
Well, yeah. He probably put that tree there.
All of the officers who were involved in Miles Gray's death have received promotions in the intervening 7 years, if that helps fuel your rage at the start of this episode. And so here we are. The inquest also did come back with a series of recommendations.
Yeah. Included amongst these recommendations are body cams, which our new city council seems very interested in pushing forward. This, of course, is only going to be effective if they are required to put them on, and something in the legislation or the court's findings allows courts to make a negative inference against the police officer if the body camera isn't turned on. Like, if the presumption is, if you don't have your body cam on, you're doing something bad, I feel like the oops, my body cam wasn't on excuse is going to suddenly, like, the amount of random equipment malfunctions is going to suddenly decrease. Also included amongst the recommendations, enhancing crisis de-escalation training, which, again, seems to go without saying. I don't really know how, like, there were 9 people there in addition to Miles Gray, and one of those people in that particular interaction ended up dead. The others had very minor wounds. I cannot understand why we, like, there were choices that were made going into this particular confrontation. And there are countries around the Japan, in for instance, where, like, there is a very strong culture and, like, set of practices involved in, like, restraining someone. Like, they have these, like, man catching tools, or people will get into altercations with police and kind of end up rolled up in a mattress. And that may sound a little funny, you know, a little crime burrito happening, but, like, it's something that has to be inculcated very strictly. If there is this wheel of force, which is the practice of securities and police forces, there's always going to be this temptation to ratchet things up, because there is a set of circumstances where deadly force is going to be permissible. If that is the case, like, there just has to be, like, a wholesale revision as to how the police are allowed to interact with the public. Finally, amongst their recommendations, the PHSA is going to review retention of relevant toxicological samples.
Yeah, I guess part of the issues that's come up is they haven't been able to go back to the original evidence of whether or not Miles Gray was on substances during this interaction, because the evidence was destroyed. And so they need to review whether it should be retained longer until all investigations are complete, which, again, seems like these are, like, minimal asks, whereas I think you're talking about more important cultural changes that really need to be examined, which kind of just, like, leads me to just, like, re-upping some historical information and just discussions on policing in Vancouver. You wanted to flag one particular article. I know.
Yes. This particular article, again, starts out with a discussion of Miles Gray, but it is an article that was published March 10th, 2017. We will link it in the show notes, by Archie Mann, entitled "Stop Ignoring the Brutal Racist History of the Vancouver Police Department." This article was published, like, both in the context of the Miles Gray case, which has been unfolding for many years, as has been mentioned, but also the kind of comparison to some of the more negative press coverage that Toronto's police force had been receiving, particularly for their use of card checks or systemic racism against Black and Indigenous people in particular. This is, I think, something that, like, a lot of British Columbians don't realize, because as the last election shows, the propaganda is strong in this province. The Vancouver Police Force has a very effective PR game going on, and it has allowed them to present themselves as a organization that is, like, accurately and appropriately responding to the, like, problems of the city, and not one that is engaged in a campaign of, like, regulatory capture of government function, which is my personal opinion on what they are doing.
Yeah. I also pulled from Daniel Francis's history book, Becoming Vancouver, because as I was reading that, the police would come up occasionally in the history of Vancouver, as they would, and so often not in a good light. For example, in 1886, the first chief constable was John Stewart. Daniel Francis goes on to note that for the most part, the cells of that initial jail were filled with drunks drying out after a night in one of Gastown's several bars. Quote, fines imposed on its brothel keepers were a mainstay of the city's budget in the early years. He would go on to talk about how in the 20s, there was a lot of concern about speakeasies and brothels. And so there was just kind of this continual pushback in the political circles between corrupt police officials basically like taking fines and using that to fund the city and politicians happily accepting that money. And then like the next guy coming in and wanting to reform everything.
You know, if you legalize sex work, you could just call that fine a tax.
That's essentially what L.D. Taylor did. Is Taylor, Vancouver's longest serving mayor over non-continuous term, basically set up that one part of Vancouver was the crime area. It's where the sex work, where the alcohol and all of the bad stuff could happen. But then the crime wouldn't happen everywhere, the quote unquote crime. And, you know, that would work at sometimes, but, and Taylor described this as, he's not here to make Vancouver, quote, a Sunday school town. But then, you know, that upsets some of the moralists later, Daniel Francis would say, and people like Jerry Maguire would come in and fire the police chief and bring in someone else. And there was a lot of firing of the police chief in the past of Vancouver because they would just randomly switch over based
on... So, like, I can see in that the seeds for where we are now. Like, if the police chief position and general control of the police were being abused by city council, I can kind of understand why the province created the system where there was no accountability. There's no accountability now for the police to city council. So, like, very much the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And, like, the situation that we are in right now is a reaction to the situations of the past. Maybe it is time for the pendulum to swing back the other way.
I can go on more of these anecdotes because they're fun if you want to hear
a couple. Please do.
All right. So Maguire, I just mentioned, appoints this new police chief and really wants to get into how much corruption there was. So he forces the resignation of Police Chief Cameron. Colonel W.W. Foster, a former conservative member of provincial legislature and a World War I veteran and an experienced mountaineer, but not a former cop, becomes the new police chief.
That's always what you want in a police officer, someone with no experience in what they're doing.
If you need to change culture, that might be the way to do it.
It might be. It might be the way to do it.
Quote, in February, a report by the force's new legal advisor alleged that under Cameron's administration, quote, commercialized vice and organized crime, quote, had flourished under the protection of senior officers. In the end, the alcoholic completely discredited Cameron was arrested, though charges against him were dismissed at trial, suggesting the VPD was perhaps not as corrupt as Maguire's campaign alleged. Several gangsters did receive prison sentences, including Joe Salona, and the VPD received a thorough reorganization.
Yeah, well, it's, yeah, like, kind of unsurprising.
The other one I want to tell out of here is the story of Walter Mulligan, the police chief in 1947. He comes in following another set of scandals in the Vancouver police. Quote, at 42 years old, he was the youngest chief in the force's history. He was supposed to be another new broom that swept it all clean, but the old patterns asserted themselves. In 1952, for example, the force was embroiled in a highly public accusations of racist brutality. Early in the morning of July 19th, a 52-year-old stevedore named Clarence Clemens got into a scuffle with the police at New Station Cafe on Main Street. Continuing it up, on this occasion, Clemens, who was black, ended up in jail cell charged with assault, complaining of pain and partially paralyzed. He was taken to hospital where doctors could not find anything wrong with him. After his wife bailed him out of jail, Clemens continued to experience serious discomfort. A few days later, he lapsed into a coma, which he never recovered, and he died just before Christmas. Going on, when he died, an inquest was convened. It opened in January 1953, attracting overflowing courtroom with front page headlines. The all-white jury heard for more than 50 witnesses, some of whom said they saw police bludgeoning Clemens, others claiming he was a troublesome drunk who resisted arrest. In the end, it was the medical evidence, or lack of it, that led the jury to exonerate the police and conclude he had pre-existing conditions. More troubling for Chief Mulligan were the rumors of corruption and influence peddling that swirled around the force. According to the tabloid press, Vancouver was, quote, gangland Eden, where officers, including the chief, regularly received bribes from gamblers, bootleggers, and brothel keepers. In 1955, the provincial government appointed a commissioner city lawyer, Reginald Tupper, to look into the allegations. For several months, he heard testimony. Chief Mulligan's mistress was among the witnesses, along with various colorful underworld figures and crooked cops. One member of the force committed suicide, another tried to kill himself and failed. Every night, listeners hung by their radios to hear Jack Webster give the blow-by-blow. Mulligan himself was accused of being on the take, unable to stand the pressure. He resigned his job, decamped from California, where he found work at a flower nursery. Tupper's report confirmed the chief had been accepting bribes, but no charges were ever laid. Vancouver's youngest police chief oversaw a racist administration and then ran out of town when it turned out he was corrupt as fuck.
So, I don't know. It's very disheartening. Like, it seems...
Yes.
Like, is there ever going to be a way that we can provide the service that the police are... Like, there is a required service that the police have to provide. Like, that something has to provide. Something has to provide policing services. Whether that is the police as they are currently constituted or have been constituted in any other way is an open question, I think. Not one that a lot of people are talking about, but like, I want the police doing more things. I want them to stop absorbing the roles of social worker and nurse and city planner and like every aspect of city control, like getting subsumed in this sort of like slow campaign of regulatory expansion of their role. But like to get them back to a basic service provision role of a very specific and narrow service. What that looked like, I am not sure. Like at the federal level, it was determined, you know, a while ago that having the RCMP act as, for example, our spies was a bad idea. Like we've been down this road before. I just find it very, it's like we're sleepwalking into a disaster.
Well, speaking of disasters and policing, let's turn our attention to Surrey. You mentioned the RCMP. The continual debate there that we've been teasing and covering is, should they keep the RCMP or should they continue expanding the Surrey Police Service? We know this was what the entire last election was fought on, and the one before that. Doug McCallum famously pushed for the Surrey Police, started to get it, and the province forced the clown of a mayor to try to do it coherently. Surrey elected a new clown who wants to go back to the RCMP and is making a mess of it again. It was finally put in the province's lap to say, what should they do? And they responded, go ahead with the Surrey Police Service. And you know what? Just to make this happen, we're going to cover the bill.
So, in a press conference that was broadcast live across the country, Solicitor General and Minister of Public Safety Mike Farnworth announced that BC was going to recommend that Surrey move to the Surrey Police Service and would pay to cover the transition costs so that Surrey taxpayers would not have to foot the bill for the roughly $235 million or, to hear Brenda Locke tell it, all the money that has ever existed in transitioning to the service, because there are going to be some increased costs associated with that. Specifically, they are going to need to hire 400 more officers, and it could take 3 years. And the RCMP, by contrast, would need to hire 161 additional officers, although that accounts in part for the fact that they have lost 140 since the Surrey Police Service started.
Yeah, Global News goes on to report about this report that Mike Farnworth received and is putting to the city of Surrey, and we'll get into that in a minute, that the municipality in its attempts to account for this didn't include enough detail on how Surrey Police would be dissolved and what that would mean HR-wise. That led the director of police services, who wrote this new report, to conclude it is likely they underestimated the costs of a complete reversal to keep the RCMP in. Basically, they made it look better to go to the RCMP than it would. They're in a boondoggle either way. And so You either spend money to get something that every mid and large size city in Canada has, which is their own police force, or you go back to the traffic cops in rural BC, as well as the former spies and the like mess of a thing that is the RCMP.
Yeah, I'm just going to float it out there that BC once had a provincial police force. I'm just leaving that on the table. Now, somewhat disappointingly, they did not go with the, we're going to impose this entire south of the Fraser police force by fiat. Now, nothing that Farnworth has said specifically has precluded this, theoretically.
Yeah, but, and Farnworth has teased that there will be reforms to the Police Act coming legislatively in the fall, but it seems unlikely he's going to go as far as a new provincial police force, which was recommended by the committee that studied it, as the number one thing to do.
Mm-hmm. No, we wouldn't want to do something radical. Otherwise, someone might confuse this government for a new Democrat.
Or even Gordon Campbell. The rock and hard place that the provincial government has put themselves in is that the Police Act as it stands gives the authority to the municipality to choose who polices them. So Brenda Locke had been teasing that if the province forced them to go with Surrey Police, she would sue. And I think that's what tied them up because, and why it took Mike Farnworth and the province to get something out so fast. I think the other challenge they have, and the reason the province really wants them to go with Surrey Police, is if they go back to RCMP, that really screws over rural policing in the rest of the province, as suddenly RCMP detachments are sending officers to Surrey when the province wants them to go to remote and rural communities that are also facing hiring shortages.
Yeah. Again, the idea that we have to be dependent on a national force that has like not only the like policing of Castlegar in mind, but also Northern sovereignty, for example, is, I feel like it's just a relic of the fact that like we are still trapped in John A. MacDonald's fever dream. Like Wilfrid Laurier tried to wake us up for a second and then we just went right back to sleep. And basically, Brenda Locke has continued to claim that she has not received the unredacted report or proof of the promised funds and is still committed to the RCMP. I don't know why she is doing this. Maybe it's because that admitting that her entire campaign was an excuse to try and get herself into power, simply on the fact that she is a politician that does politician things and not, for example, the proxy wedge that was used to fight the last election instead of saying the last mayor is a criminal, which, as it turns out, not culpably, at least.
Yeah, it seems like Locke is a serial liar to me. I'm not saying that definitively or accusatively, just like the vibes I'm getting of the statement she is making, because like, I don't know, it just feels like a matter of time before she's claiming her foot gets run over as well, speaking of that other guy. But like, she's making claims that, you know, Treasury Board hasn't officially approved this disbursement of funds, but it's like, this is politics. They can do it and they have a majority government. They'll do it if they need to. They're not going to preemptively cut you a check. Mike Farnworth, for his part, has said he will give her the full unredacted report tomorrow morning if she actually signs the non-disclosure agreement that the province has put before them. Locke's response was, I didn't know there was a non-disclosure. Bullshit, you didn't. And now she is saying, as of today, that the NDA that was proposed was untenable because this should be a fully transparent process.
Yeah. Well, it really seems this is a case of lock, stock, and two smoking barrels. Total nonsense. I don't even know. I don't know. It obviously, municipalities are creatures of the province here. And if the provincial government wants something, they will get it. And now that they have come out and said that this thing is going to happen, or that this is their recommendation, you can bet 100% that this is going to be what happens. I cannot imagine a circumstance in which the provincial government with the majority is going to let the mayor of Surrey push them around on this. there
the mayor who got 28% in the election.
Yes. It's absolutely ridiculous. Like, if you somehow manage to barely win against Doug McCallum, you don't have a strong mandate.
Doug McCallum barely won the previous election. Like, Surrey does not know who they want to lead them.
No, they do not. As opposed to Vancouver, which is very clear on the fact that
they don't want Katie Stewart.
The president? No. Anyway, in other environs news, Langley's, both of them, not to be confused with our other twin municipalities, the North Vancouver's, also both want the RCMP, but somehow different. Township has voted for establishing their own RCMP detachment. This would be distinct from city's RCMP detachment.
This is basically the story of why there are so many municipalities in Metro Vancouver, because you get a rural area that thinks those damn city dwellers are stealing all their tax money, and so they want to split and do their own thing, or vice versa.
I mean, like, God forbid we subject the poor people of the District of North Vancouver to the newfangled innovation of electricity. I'm sure that won't catch on.
So the township doesn't want to pay for the higher policing costs that it takes to patrol the, you know, quote unquote downtown, the more dense area, the Langleys, which is in the city, because they are sharing RCMP right now. This is not a quick process. Pitt Meadows is trying to break its detachment off of Maple Ridge. It started that in 2019 and is still ongoing.
Now, like, do I think that a unified South of the Fraser police force might be able to establish a detachment in Langley and another detachment in Langley and allocate resources that would somehow be, like, if we're going to have completely unaccountable police forces, and we are, apparently, then we could at least have them work effectively and be, at the very least, regionally confined and responsible. A South of the Fraser police force that included the Langleys could allocate their funds appropriately between Langley and Richmond and Delta and such, as you do. It's something that, well, basically on global policing, like on regional policing, global sites, Cashie, the former public safety minister and solicitor general under the BC Liberals, and who said that when his government studied the issues, this is, of course, the Cashie who basically kind of had to leave in disgrace.
I love that they quoted him.
Said that when his government studied the issues in 2010, it concluded that such a change could be completed in 2 to 3 years.
That's what I mean about Gordon Campbell's administration. Say what you will, but they had, like, ambition to do things. They weren't always things I liked, but they did them fast and hard.
They did do them. They absolutely did. And if you want a truly excellent, like, exercise in, like, mind-blowing cognitive dissonance, truly pick up George Abbott's book, where it feels like he thinks he was like this anthropologist who was like embedded inside the cabinet of the BC Liberals in like the era from 2001 to 2005. And like that era of like massive tax cuts that, you know,
did a number.
But somehow the entire thing seems to be completely devoid of any sense of like personal responsibility for what he did. Like, he's very critical of the whole thing, but it's all written in this weird kind of passive voice, especially when his ministry is concerned. It's like, and then somehow the funds were cut by me. And even that is like going beyond what probably he would admit having done himself. Still, it's a mind-blowing thing. He must have been high when he was writing it. Maybe he bought drugs from the new drugs store.
Amazing branding. So this is just a fantastic story with a sad ending, but not a full conclusion yet.
This is merely the beginning.
So Jerry Martin announced quite a while ago that, like, with decriminalization of personal possession in BC, he was going to open a drugstore. He called it the drugstore because he's A-plus at branding. He rented like a little trailer and essentially just started selling cocaine, crack cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, and MDMA, all tested to be free of fentanyl.
And at quite reasonable prices.
Yeah, the Global News has a picture of the prices. So, you know, if you want to do crack, it's like $20. Unsurprisingly, Vancouver police busted him within 24 hours. In their press release, they mentioned that they launched an investigation into this guy who bragged that he was doing crimes.
Hello, crimes. Crime shop over here. Doing crimes. I'm also planning on launching a charter challenge when you arrest me. Crimes. And then, of course, not really to anyone's surprise, including Terry Martin's, they arrested him. And this is going to be proceeding to a charter challenge, according to Mr. Martin and presumably his lawyer.
Martin did lose $15,000 of cash that police seized during the, I don't know, arrest. You can barely call it a raid when you just like go to the guy selling cocaine from a booth that says the drugstore. It's like a food truck, but with crack cocaine. It's just,
yeah, but like no fentanyl, which
is a very good service.
Yeah.
To the community that is dying
of
fentanyl.
It's almost like this is a job that someone should be doing.
More and more people are saying this.
Like, the people are not going to stop doing the drugs because no one has ever stopped people from doing drugs ever in the history of humanity. Like, we just like drugs as a species for some reason. And is that reason that, like, our society grinds us down in a manner that indicates that, like, human life isn't as valuable as money? Maybe. But, short of societal reform, drugs.
So we'll follow Jerry Martin's continuing story, and in hopes that we get just a smidge of societal reform that takes us out of our individualizing, soul-crushing vehicles, City Council are now going to look at a car-free pilot in Gastown, thanks to, I think, a unanimous council motion moved by Councillor Sarah Kirby-Young.
Fantastic.
Get the cars off Water Street, finally.
Yeah, a road that was clearly not built for anything with wheels, to be honest, having ridden that in a bike as well. And honestly, I'm not even sure how horses could go down that thing. But returning Gastown to the people, I mean, like, streets used to be public. Like, they used to be a thing that you could just walk out into. And years of relentless lobbying by automobile and oil industries have privatized, or rather restricted, a large part of the public realm to, like, a private consumer product.
I love that Global and News got buses, the comment, right? Van City Tours tour guide Dominique Champagne, who says, "We take our tours through Gastown, so where are we going to take our tours now? On foot through Gastown, like many walking tour companies do. And if you visit anywhere in Europe, there are lots of non-bus tours that are great."
I honestly, like, I am so shocked that a tour company would be opposed to this, that, like, when you started saying this, I had not conceived of the idea that they would have been upset. Like, this is going to be good. It is going to make a part of the city that is, as with all things with cars, kind of unpleasant to traverse as a pedestrian, into a very nice part of the city. Like, you know, what is one of the best places to exist? One of the most popular tourist destinations in Vancouver? It's Granville Island, a place with some severely restricted car passage. Maybe not enough, but that's not for me to say. That is for the unaccountable and unelected federal board that runs Granville Island.
And hopefully they can fix the routing of traffic that, if you're coming in, which I've done many times from like that Powell Street way into downtown, it just dumps you on Water Street. Suddenly you're like, I don't want to be here in my car. this feels wrong. Everyone is anxious in this situation, from drivers who are bumping over those rocks with pedestrians everywhere to pedestrians not wanting to get run over.
Mm-hmm.
Turn people like up those Main Street
for
or
stopping
anything,
but... anyone. Like, no. I have seen cars knock down those bollards on a number of occasions, and they just rip them out of the pavement because everything is cobblestones. It is absurd. Speaking of ripping pieces of public infrastructure, publicly owned funds, out of the hands of the public, and segue, perfect, the anti-homes tax. Vancouver has given developers a $3 million check. Council, for whatever reason, has voted to cancel a planned increase to 5% of the anti-homes tax, because apparently the problems are solved.
The staff report came through saying there are disadvantages to increasing the tax too much. There were some people being caught by it who shouldn't have been, and there were a number of exemptions that council passed on. I mean, a strong-willed council who's believed in the empty homes tax would have said, fuck it, raise it and go to 5, 10%, you know, put everything on the market, whatever. This council is not that. One of the exemptions, though, flagged by staff was for, quote, newly built units that haven't been sold to their first occupant yet.
These people absolutely can go fuck themselves.
Yeah.
Like, if you are not building what the market is demanding, if you have made a bet that has not panned out in our capitalist world, you do not deserve a handout from the government. You do not deserve an exemption from the taxes. You have taken up so much of the manpower and capital that is required to build these houses, and you have made the wrong bet. If there is something that is going to change the behavior of developers to get them to stop building houses that are effectively financial instruments and change them into something that is actually going to house families in the city, this is going to be it. This is bad.
You said very forcefully what I was thinking more technocratically, which was like the solution here, if you are a developer who built a tower and you can't get your units to sell, is to lower the price of them, which should be the point of this tax, is to make housing more affordable.
Yes.
Instead, Mike Klassen supporting this exemption, which was recommended by staff among others. The others are more like, your unit is uninhabitable because of like a toxic disaster happened inside of it. And it's like, okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
They were more reasonable exemptions.
I'm all for the toxic disaster exemption. Let things be known that I am not against all homeowners, per se.
But Mike Klassen said this exemption doesn't go far enough, and he moved a successful amendment to make it retroactive to 2022, and that is why city now has to cut a check of $3.8 million in tax revenue that it has been collected and is in city bank accounts and just refund it. And it's like, I don't know of a single government that has ever untaxed someone in this way. They have canceled tax increases. They have lowered tax rates, but never, as far as I know, retroactively been like, sorry, we took your money. Here it is back.
I mean, it's just corporate welfare. Like, this is just like humbug. Humbug.
But Klassen was asked why this was the place. He said it's to send a signal to the housing industry that they need to get working. That's not how that works.
I agree. Maybe they should start working on what they should actually be fucking building, what the market is demanding and what is needed in the city, instead of building houses that no one wants to live in.
He's going to work with industry to make sure that happens, though, Matthew. He didn't provide specific
thank God.
What that means.
The industry, it's been so responsive so far. Fuck.
Let's go to Burnaby and talk about how responsive their city council has been. They are still having the fallout of the abandoned alternative approval process. So fucking mess there. They have so much egg on that council's face for how mad people got. That long time, like over 20 year councillor, Sav Dhaliwal, got to the point of asking staff to prepare a report as to whether council has the authority to ban themselves from ever using AAP again. To which staff said, no, just don't do it. Your council.
Yeah, that's like, the alternative approval process is a bylaw.
No, it's in the community charter.
Oh, it's in the community charter. Okay. That's my mistake. No, they can't. They can't do that, at least in any way that would be meaningful, because a council could just unban themselves.
Yeah, they could pass a recommendation to future councils, which is words on a piece of paper.
Like, no shit, this happened. Like, actually, putting this in a letter and being like, open in case of if ever wanting to use this policy again, and then it's just being like, no, signs have dolly wall, isn't a bad idea, because like, this process is undemocratic, and honestly, should never have been used for this, because obviously it was going to make people angry. It was supposed to be for uncontroversial things, like disposing of like whatever land that you had to seize from the like area around the refinery because it's now toxic waste and you want to get rid of it or whatever, to sell it to a remediation company or whatever. It's something that should not have been used to sell a city park.
They did note that for this process, which required about 16,000 votes to be considered valid, they had received requests for 46,900 ballots. 44,600 of those came from just 52 individuals who were bulk ordering them in the first 3 weeks.
That shouldn't be allowed.
That was like a lot of fucking ballots per person. Like, many were requesting 1,000 at a time.
That shouldn't be allowed. That doesn't sound right to me. Doesn't seem like a person. It sounds like fucking Tammany Hall bullshit to me. Like, I'm all for city council like wearing this defeat at like the absolute nonsense bomb that it was. But it shouldn't be allowed to order 1,000 ballots. Seems bad.
Yeah, like campaign organizers would want to have a stack on hand so they could be at a mall and get like a bunch of signatures at once, but 1,000 is excessive.
Yeah.
Person.
Maybe like 100.
Or you have like a more online friendly system that doesn't require the paper mail in.
How many?
They are looking at that. Anyway, yeah. They can't tie their future hands. The other story out of Burnaby, though, is they are looking at moving City Hall.
Yes. So right now, Burnaby City Hall is a kind of ugly box in the middle of nowhere.
It's like geographic center of Burnaby, almost.
Yeah, which is, of course, a mistake. Yeah, a mistake. It's a mistake. It looks like a prison.
It's by Deer Lake, so it is like just off the highway at that Kensington overpass. There's no SkyTrain there. There's a few buses that go along Canada Way, but yeah, it is an out of the way, roughly, place. They want to move it to Metrotown, where it'll be like the new downtown of Burnaby.
Good. You know what? Good. City Hall should be where people are, because people are responsible for holding City Hall to account. Yeah. And if you make your City Hall in the middle of an inaccessible forest, can really only get to by nature walk or car, it makes it difficult for people to hold you to account. And that is why you end up tricking yourself into making stupid decisions, like selling off a city park to build a sewage treatment plant without any public consultation.
And if your building is physically inaccessible and would cost $70 million to upgrade to modern accessibility standards, so seems like good decision, but they're probably at the point of pissing a lot of people off in Burnaby, and so tread lightly, counselors.
I mean, now is the time to do stuff like this. Like, you've got one more year of, like, getting the big ticket items out of the way before, like, people begin to have a memory that they will continue to vote on the next election. Why this would matter in Burnaby is an open question to me, because, of course, as we all know, the BCA will never lose there, never have, never will, unless, of course, you are the mayor. That one time. But Burnaby, 'twas ever thus. I don't know, democracy. Also, if you want to attract, talented people who might not want to have a car like dependent lifestyle and also work at City Hall, maybe having the City Hall accessible by SkyTrain is a good thing. It's, I think, good all round. Honk. Every episode of the Cambie Report, we conclude with a little Vancouverada. And this week, well, we won't be flying south over the winter. We will be settling down with Vancouver's resident geese, which we're going to kill.
Yeah, so a bit of a news tie-in, and I'll come back to that in a minute. So the Canada goose is familiar to probably every listener. It's the iconic bird that is also a terror, murder, violent animal that you keep clear of. And it also shits everywhere.
Honestly, I'm just so disappointed that the Canada goose is not our national bird. Like, I like the Whiskey Jack, don't get me wrong, or is... Canadian Geographic decided to call it the Grey Jay to remove any trace of like indigeneity from the naming. But the Canada goose is a monster of a bird. It is like they're all dinosaurs, but like this thing, you know it. And, you know, if our other national animal is the beaver, which, you know, industry notwithstanding, and no other animal has had a greater impact on the ecosystems of the world other than humans than the beaver. I want like a little bit of a menace to be our national bird. And I wish it was the Canada goose instead of nothing.
So,
which is what it is right now.
The goose has a fascinating history and part of this is from Wikipedia, Canada goose. By the early 20th century, overhunting and loss of habitat had resulted in serious decline in the numbers of the bird in its native range. The giant Canada goose subspecies was believed to be extinct in the 1950s until in 1962, a small flock was discovered wintering in Rochester, Minnesota. They started breeding those and having a restoration program. They had 64 pens with 64 breeding pairs of high quality birds. And by the end of 1981, more than 6,000 Canada geese had been released at 83 sites in 26 counties just in North Dakota. Vancouver's own website notes that Vancouver's geese were reintroduced in the 1960s and 70s to, quote, enhance wildlife viewing and hunting, which it's just wild to me to think about a year where geese. We are now at a point where the Vancouver Parks Board is being told that if nothing is done or little is done, there could be geese overrunning the city. Nevertheless, what's fascinating about the Vancouver geese, well, even more, is the geese in Metrovan don't migrate. It's just too nice here.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of geese in a lot of places don't migrate. There are two distinct populations of Canada goose. There are the migratory geese, which are still protected and, you know, reasonably so. It is a particular part of the biosphere that can indeed get endangered or... And now, because of their particular ability to thrive in the city park biome, the resident geese, which live with us all year, everywhere.
Yeah, so this staff report estimated that there's about at least 2,200 in Vancouver as of 2022. It's growing at 18% per year because these geese are horny. And there could be, from that 2,200, 10,000 by 2030. So imagine five times as many geese as there are now, Matthew. Doesn't that make you want to strangle a goose?
Dear Lord, wow. That would be so much foie gras. I don't know. I kind of wish there was an ability to go hunting them, wish there was a way to sustainably manage them. I wish there was a way that the cull could be managed in a way that, you know, didn't waste the goose meat.
Yeah, so the board had considered two proposed management scenarios. The first is a long timeline, 15 to 20 year non-murder system that involves, quote, addling and enforcement. Addling is where you go find a goose nest, shake the eggs so they're infertile, but then the goose
also oil them.
Yeah, you basically abort them. You do a bunch of goose abortions, but then leave the eggs there so they think their eggs are still around and they don't go laying more. The challenge with this is it can get really hard to find geese nests. The second option was a 5 to 10 year timeline that included quote, population reduction through removal. They have gone with that, but a cull would require sign-off from provincial and federal environment authorities. Anyway, after approving murdering coyotes, the park board is now up for murdering geese. And they will be willing to spend $375,000 on this.
Well, if it's that or a laugh, I mean, at least someone's finding a home in Vancouver.
Speaking of, you can report Goose Nest to the city by calling 311 or emailing geese@vancouver.ca, and city staff will go there and pick it up for you.
Yeah, don't break the eggs. The geese will just lay more. If you must do it yourself, take care of yourself. Oil them, I guess. I don't know. Don't really. Just call city staff. Don't mess with the eggs. But it is an ongoing problem that we will keep you posted on as the goose hunt begins. For Legged Boot Media, I'm Matthew Naylor.
I'm Ian Bushfield.
Good night.